Several times during the talks today, you probably saw this strange name given to one of the five string theories called heterotic. Well, our next speaker is one of the originators of that, of those two heterotic string theories during the first superstring revolution in the mid-80s. Earlier, in the 70s, he was one of the main people developing the standard model that we heard about. He's our current ITP director, and it's a pleasure to welcome David Gross.
Well, from what I gather, I'm not as as high-tech as Brian was, but so one of the advantages of not hearing the other wonderful talk, or I heard part of Hiroshi's, is that I can repeat many of the things I said without being guilty, feeling guilty. But I thought it would be a good idea to close this conference with a discussion of the questions that we're asking currently and the changes that we see coming in what is really an ongoing revolution. I hope you got some sense that string theory is not a final completed theory that's ready to go into textbooks at any level. It's rather a revolution in progress. Revolution in progress. Some of us feel that it is in a stage where rather deep revolutions are beginning to occur, but they haven't yet occurred, and we have really no idea what the final story will look like. And it's that set of questions and possible speculations about those revolutions that I would like to tell you about. Now, as you know, string theory has become very popular, and I thought as an example of this, one of the many examples that I found in the popular press, how string theory has permeated popular culture, and one that's quite appropriate for the subject of much of what I'll be talking about, is a mention of string theory that I found in Hannibal. I don't know how many of you have seen the movie, and I haven't yet seen the movie, but the book is fascinating. I really enjoyed it. It's, of course, the sequel to Thomas Harris's Silence of the Lambs, and it focuses on Hannibal the Cannibal, Hannibal Lecter, who is quite a character, very sophisticated. And I read this book with great joy. It's fascinating. And late in the novel, Lecter is seated in his armchair with a big pad of butcher paper doing calculations. The pages are filled with the symbols both of astrophysics and particle physics. There are repeated efforts with the symbols of string theory. The few mathematicians who could follow him might say his equations begin brilliantly and then decline, doomed by wishful thinking. Well, that might actually be quite appropriate for this talk as the end of the conference, but I hope you will bear with me. So what I intend to do is to start out with a description of 10 questions that were chosen at the annual strings meeting. The string theorists get together once a year and try to understand what the hell is going on in string theory. And at the turn of the millennium, in 2000, there was a conference in Michigan, and because of the millennium, the organizers thought it would be a good idea to try to set forward 10 questions that would sort of summarize the important questions of the field and might have some lasting value. So the criteria was these questions had to be meaningful questions that could be answered and at the same time have lasting value, you know, not be answered within a week, And they participants were asked to submit questions, and I'll discuss those questions. They'll give you some feeling about what string theorists are thinking about. And then I'll focus on the kinds of conceptual revolutions that we might be forced in pursuing this theory to complete sometime in the future. And I'll end with, just for amusement's sake, with a more of a philosophical discussion of whether what does it mean to construct a theory of everything, and is it possible at all? So let me start with the 10 questions. These were chosen by a committee consisting of Michael Duff, Ed Witten, and myself at String 2000 from a submitted list of about 70 questions. We were concerned at the beginning there wouldn't be very, you know, enough good questions. There were plenty of good questions, and so many have been left out. And we chose 10 of them. And we excluded a whole bunch of questions. We didn't exclude, but the participants excluded many important and fundamental questions in other areas of physics. So these are not really the 10 top questions in physics, not to speak of the 10 top questions in science. They're just the 10 top questions that are on the minds of string theorists at this conference. We also excluded personal questions like, how does one get tenure? Although the answer to that is obvious, answer one of the 10 top questions. So here are the first 5 of the 10 top questions, and I'll go through them rapidly one by one. And some of them actually have came up in Hiroshi's lecture, and I'm sure perhaps in other lectures. Let me start with the first one, which is actually my question. This was a very loose procedure, and the selection committee was not excluded from picking their own questions. But I approached this in the following way. If I was awakened from a coma 200 years from now, and I had one question to ask before I went to sleep again, what would it be? And this question is a good one because it asks, are all the measurable dimensionless parameters that characterize the physical universe calculable in principle? Or are some of them merely determined by historical or quantum mechanical accident and therefore not calculable? Now, many of us would like to believe that all dimensionless parameters that characterize the physical universe in the end have a logical mathematical explanation. And in a sense, that's one of the primary goals that motivates us and leaves us dissatisfied with the present state of our understanding of physics. The standard model is very good, but it has many dimensionless parameters, 19 by one calculation, and probably many more, given what we're now learning about neutrinos. And those are numbers like 1 over 137, a famous number that characterizes the strength of the electric force, that should have some reason for being what they are, not just arbitrary numbers that you have to measure and then take for granted. It should be, as Einstein once said, the theory should be strong enough and powerful enough so that if you were to change the values of those numbers, the whole theory would crumble. The whole artifice would no longer make any sense. Now, we don't know whether that's the case. And in fact, it is quite conceivable, there are well-motivated scenarios, where the actual values of some of the parameters that we measure and characterize the physical universe are chosen by the quantum mechanical accidents that determine the initial state of the universe. And we would be doomed never to have a theory of the fine structure constant, for example. That would be very disappointing to someone like me. And in such cases, some people resort to anthropic arguments, saying, well, the reason these numbers are the way they are is because if they weren't the way they are, we wouldn't be alive. And therefore, they are the way they are. Such anthropic arguments are not allowed in answering this question. The second question, which is actually Ed Witten's question, is how can quantum gravity help explain the origin of the universe? Notice he doesn't say string theory, he says quantum gravity. He's being careful as usual. He knows that quantum, that any theory, consistent theory of quantum gravity is likely to be a string theory. And he assumes that there is an explanation to the origin of the universe, and he asks how can, and not can one, but how can one, using in the framework of quantum gravity or string theory, explain the origin of the universe. This is really a question about the initial conditions of the universe, and it is sort of the kind of question that we ask nowadays that you have to keep hitting this machine, otherwise it goes to sleep. This is the sort of question that you know, when I was a graduate student, you weren't allowed to ask this kind of question, and very few people managed to get papers on this subject published in professional journals. It really was metaphysics. Traditional physics makes a clear distinction between the initial conditions of a physical system and the laws of physics. The role of physics traditionally is to predict the future of a system once you know its initial state. Somebody has to give you the initial conditions, and then you can, using the laws of physics, predict the system at later times. But a theory of the birth of the universe, the origin of the universe, is clearly a theory of the initial conditions. And that's sort of novel for physics, but it's sort of inevitable in a theory, in any theory of gravity, which after all, as has been discussed at length today, is a theory that says that space-time, or whatever replaces it, and we'll come to that, is actually a dynamical entity. And therefore, once you accept that, the origin of the universe is a scientific issue. Whether it's answerable or not is an open question, but it is a scientific issue, and people can write papers on this and get them published in physics journals and not in philosophical journals. In fact, my colleague Jim Hartle, and working with Stephen Hawking, was one of the first to put forward a very beautiful, well-formulated mathematical idea that would predict the origin of the universe. It's, of course, much too simplistic, but it got published. Now, string theory, in fact, we feel, or many of us feel, is just the kind of theory that might allow us, indeed require us, to understand the principle that fixes the initial conditions of the universe. In ordinary general relativity, in ordinary Einsteinian theory, which is the framework for modern cosmology, and works extraordinarily well. The recent experiments on the cosmic microwave background are an incredible confirmation of the application of Einstein's theory to the cosmos. But most of our observations of the cosmos are way after whatever happened at the beginning. And when we try to use those same equations to extrapolate backwards towards beginning, we run into a singularity, inevitably, called the Big Bang. The laws of physics break down. Einstein's equations are clearly not sufficient. Well, string theory is a theory that abhors singularities. We have discovered time and time again in string theory that whenever we try to set up a situation that would classically, or that would seem to produce a singularity, string theory somehow manages to avoid those singularities. It does so often by changing the way in which one finds it most appropriate to treat the theory. So that one might very well expect that if we had enough power to really understand what was happening in a stringy cosmology that looked like our universe today, and extrapolate it back, we would not find a singularity. The only thing that would happen would be would be that the description that we were using would break down. But that wouldn't mean that there's something singular and awful going on. It would mean we would have to shift to a dual or different description. And maybe, as often is the case, that dual description would provide us with a principle that indeed fixes what we would interpret later as the initial condition of the universe. Well, this is an open question whether we can do this, but if any theory is likely to, it is string theory. So let me go down to the third question. This actually is a question, although asked by string theorists who are totally divorced from experiment, is largely an experimental question. It is, what is the lifetime of the proton? And how do we understand it? Now again, these questions are well formulated. This question assumes that the proton has a lifetime, namely is unstable. A proton just sitting here in this room will decay at some rate. And how do we understand it? So let me explain to you why we are sure that protons should decay and diamonds are not forever. There are many reasons. First reason is that in a unified theory, we naturally expect proton decay. The reason protons are stable, unlike neutrons, for example, neutrons decay by beta decay, by radioactivity, to protons and electrons and neutrinos. But the proton is stable because something is conserved, cannot disappear. And that's called the baryon number, or the proton number. It's actually the quark number. A proton is made out of three quarks, and quarks just can't disappear. Their number is conserved. It's like electric charge is conserved. But in a unified theory, protons and leptons, protons and quarks and electrons are all mixed up. And almost in any unified theory you can write down, and certainly the first unified theories that people wrote down, and certainly string theory, protons just decay. That's part of the theory. And in fact, the search for proton decay in the lab has been going on ever since attempts were made to unify all the theories at a scale, not really the Planck scale, but lower than that. And it was established that the lifetime of the proton is bigger than 10 to the 34 years. You might ask, how can you possibly measure a lifetime of 10 to 34 years, which is much bigger than the life of the time of the universe? Well, the answer is you don't look at one proton, you look at 10 to the 34 protons, and you wait till one of them decays in 1 year. And in big tanks of water in Japan, people have established very good bounds. Unfortunately, they haven't seen proton decay. Its observation would tell us an enormous amount about the nature of unified theories and the scale at which they unify. But there are also many other reasons why protons should decay. For example, Sakharov, famous Russian physicist, pointed out a long time ago that the universe has the strange property of containing protons, but very few, as far as we can tell, antiprotons. So it has matter, but very little antimatter. There's an asymmetry. And physicists don't like asymmetries. They love symmetry. And if there's a symmetry, they like to understand how the asymmetry arises as some kind of breaking. You've heard about spontaneous symmetry breaking of symmetries. But if the universe has more baryons, one way of understanding that, and probably the only rational way, is to assume that it started out with no baryon number, and then as it cooled down, baryons and antibaryons were produced, and the antibaryons decayed more than the baryons. That's possible if the world doesn't have a symmetry called CP symmetry, which we know it doesn't have, and it's also required that protons have to be able to decay, or more appropriately, antiprotons. A third reason is that even in the standard model, protons do decay. There are processes. Even in the standard model, that lead to proton decay, although at extraordinarily low rates. And finally, in a theory of gravity, you can't have baryon conservation. We don't believe that there are any conservation laws of the type of the number of quarks or the number of protons. And indeed, that's a feature not of standard Einsteinian gravity coupled to the standard model, but of string theory. And the general reason is that if you have a proton all by itself sitting here, there's some probability that it's a black hole. Now, a proton isn't a black hole because it's much bigger than a black hole would be with the same mass. But there's some probability that the proton, which has a certain size of 10 to the minus 13 centimeters, isn't actually that big. Just like there's a very small probability that I'm not standing here at this moment, but rather on the other side of the wall in any quantum mechanical situation. So if you wait long enough, the proton at some point will be a black hole. And then as you've been, it's been explained to you, a black hole will emit decay by thermal radiating away. And the proton number, the baryon number, the number of quarks will have disappeared. So we believe that this is a general feature of string theory, of any theory, any unified theory, any theory containing quantum gravity. And we would love to know what the lifetime is because it will teach us a lot about that unifying theory. And we would love to know how the proton decays. And that's the kind of question that could be determined experimentally, if we're lucky. I'll get there. Question number four, is nature supersymmetric? And if so, how is supersymmetry broken? Now, I think that Joe explained to you a bit about what supersymmetry is. And again, this question is largely experimental. This is experiment will answer this question. Somebody said in the question period that we might have to redefine what physics is. Well, no way. In the end, experiment is going to decide this question. Although the second question will be, as usual, probably a common endeavor of experimenters and theorists. So I think, as Joe probably explained, supersymmetry is a natural and in some ways very unique extension of relativity, of the relativistic and general relativistic symmetries of nature. It has the marvelous feature of unifying fermions and bosons, of particles with half-integer spin like electrons, which are the constituents of matter, and particles with integer spin, 1, 0, which are the carriers of the forces of nature. It is the discovery of supersymmetry, which might very well happen in the next few years, will be, in my opinion, one of the greatest experimental discoveries of all time. And it will be tantamount to the discovery of quantum dimensions of space-time, as I think Joe explained a bit of, and I'll try to illustrate it also in the following way. We can easily imagine by now, you're all accustomed to imagining theories or worlds in which one has more spatial dimensions than just three. But you can also try to imagine something called superspace, in which one has other coordinates, other dimensions, except that unlike the normal dimensions we're accustomed to, you don't measure their extent in inches or meters, but rather in a system of numbers, which is called Grassmannian. These are numbers that don't commute, whose multiplication law is that when you take two of these numbers, theta 1, theta 2, or theta 2, theta 1, you don't get the same thing. In fact, you get a minus sign. Theta 1, theta 2 is minus theta 2, theta 1. In particular, by the way, theta 1 squared is 0, because equal to minus theta 1 squared. There are such numbers. This is the numbers. I just defined them. And you can play around with these numbers. By the way, arithmetic with these numbers is much easier than with ordinary numbers. And you can add them on as coordinates and construct a superspace. And then you can imagine theories in which you have symmetries. Now, ordinary symmetries, if this was x and this was y, like rotational symmetries, are just rotations of one spatial coordinate into another. X goes to y. If I rotate this whole room and everything in it, then all the experiments I do, here's an experiment, will be the same. If I control. So once you have the superspace, you can demand that your theory is invariant under rotations in superspace. But then you're mixing up bosonic, ordinary commuting coordinates, with these fermionic coordinates. And it's not then surprising that in supersymmetric theories, there is correspondingly a symmetry, a correspondence between every boson and every fermion. Every particle has a superpartner. And we give them names that have by now become standard. Particles like quarks and electrons, which are the primary constituents of matter in the standard model, have partners. The quark is a fermion with spin 1/2, and its associated partner is a spin 0 boson called a squark. The electron, the partner called the selectron. Photon is spin 1. There's a spin 1/2 particle called the photino, the graviton, the gravitino. And supersymmetry, were to be exact, would predict that all of these particles would have partners with the same masses and the same couplings and roughly the same physics, and we haven't seen any of this. Now, some people say that supersymmetry has done pretty well since half the particles it predicts are there. But of course, you didn't need supersymmetry for that. So the theory, the symmetry has to be broken, like most symmetries that are new. Symmetries, if the symmetry hadn't been broken, it wouldn't have been a new symmetry. We would have known about it a long time ago. And we don't know exactly whether it's there and where it's broken. There are many reasons why we would like to believe that this symmetry is part of nature. It solves many problems of the standard model. I'll say a word about that later. And from the point of view of string theory, as you've heard, it's essential. Supersymmetry, in a sense, was discovered in string theory, first realized in string theory, in the attempts to construct a theory that contains particles with half-integer spin, like the electron and the quark. And it's an integral part of string theory. You can't do without it. Therefore, particle physicists in general, and string theorists in particular, are desperately awaiting the construction of a new accelerator at CERN. CERN is the European particle physics lab, consortium of European countries, with which the United States, after our Congress in a one of the most stupid moves in history, canceled the SSC, joined together with the Europeans in helping build a machine called the LHC, which will collide protons at an energy of 14 TeV. A TeV is 1,000 GeV, and you all know what a GeV is by now. In this machine, those protons go around here between Switzerland and France, the speed of light almost, right through customs. And they collide, and in those collisions, these machines serve as microscopes, which probe the structure of matter at extraordinarily short distances. And we expect, perhaps, that this machine will allow us to do quite a bit. We expect that it will allow us to complete the standard model about which you heard so much. There are some parts of the standard model that haven't yet been experimentally totally verified, in particular the mechanism for symmetry breaking and some other things. But most importantly, this machine offers the real prospect to discover supersymmetry, which is a vast new world of particles and a great boost for string theory, to say the least. And finally, if we're very lucky and some of the interesting new ideas are correct, it's conceivable, although unlikely, that we'll see stringy effects. Okay, let's go on to the fifth question, which is, why does the universe appear to have one time and one space directions? Now, this has been discussed by many lecturers, so I'll just say a word or two about it. As you've learned, this is a dynamical question in any theory containing gravity. The global structure of space-time is a dynamical question. And in string theory, we sort of have the answer. String theory is actually the first theory in physics where you can write down equations whose solution is the number of spatial dimensions of the world. But the question here is not how many dimensions are there at, say, as viewed at short distances or in some other way, but rather, why does the universe appear to have one time and three spatial dimensions? And again, as you've already heard, there are two kinds of answers. One is the traditional answer that six of the dimensions are compactified in a small, say, Calabi-Yau, and four is not correct here. It should be six. Six-dimensional space. And that's the traditional answer within string theory. But as Hiroshi explained, there's another possibility, and that's that we live on a brain. We actually are made out of open strings that live on a brain. And the only, and it's only gravity that extends to all of space. Of course, gravity will exist in all dimensions because gravity is the dynamics of space-time itself. But it can very well be, as on brains, that you have particles like quarks and electrons and carriers of force like photons and gluons that can only live on the brain. And these scenarios are very different in nature and lead to very different predictions. And we, again, don't know which is correct or something else. So this is a very important question for string theory. And this one might even be, as was remarked, as you heard about, might even be have much more immediate experimental implications. There's also in this question, the question as to why the universe appears to only have one time dimension. This was asked in the question period. And that's a probably more profound question. Why is there only one time? Hiroshi alluded a bit to why this is a more complicated question. And I'll come back to that a little bit later. So I finished half the questions. Here are the second half. They have to do with, let me go through them one by one. The first is the cosmological constant. Why does the cosmological constant have the value that it has, and is it zero? Again, this is partly an experimental question. And you might think it's a question of cosmology. So I should, after all, it has cosmology in its title. What is the cosmological constant, anyway, and what does it have to do with string theory? Cosmological constant is sort of the energy density of the vacuum. So if you create a pure vacuum with nothing in it, that state of matter, the state of physical state, with nothing there, can still carry some energy per unit volume. And in a quantum mechanical theory, and we measure it by measuring this parameter here, and it sort of tells you how much energy there is, say, in a cubic centimeter of vacuum. And of course, the vacuum in a quantum mechanical system is a very complicated thing because of the fact that in quantum mechanics, you can't really say that something is at absolute rest in the classical way of understanding absolute rest. You have something that doesn't has no kinetic energy and is just fixed at a place. If you know that it's at a place, then it has to have some momentum, some uncertainty in your knowledge of its momentum. So there's kind of always a zero-point motion of all particles, and even in the vacuum, where they're not subjected to any other forces or interactions. And those zero-point fluctuations of all the degrees of freedom in the universe can contribute to the energy density of the vacuum, which makes it a very difficult thing to calculate. And normally, in a quantum field theory or in a standard model with the old-fashioned tools, you calculate this number, you get infinity. And then most physicists, or the traditional reaction to finding infinities, is to say, well, infinity is obviously unphysical, so we ignore it. Throw it away. Subtract it off. And that's okay as long as you're not doing cosmology. But this is an infinity in energy, and energy reacts back onto geometry, and such an energy density in the vacuum, infinite or even finite, has a big effect on the structure of the universe. And that's how it can be measured as well. And, well, so normally we don't know how to calculate this in any realistic situation, and we still don't, even with string theory. But we can make back-of-the-envelope calculations, and of the kind that you've been subjected to throughout today. And you've heard about the Planck mass, which is sort of the characteristic mass scale of the universe, the fundamental parameter with dimensions of energy or mass. And so the typical scale back-of-the-envelope calculation would give you the fourth power of the Planck mass, which is 10 to the 120 electron volt to the fourth power. Well, what are we going to compare it with? You might compare it with observation. And if you do, it's more than 120 orders of magnitude off. Now, that's a big mistake. Well, the traditional answer of physicists to this was, this was a too crude a calculation. There must be some symmetry or reason why the cosmological constant should be zero. There's some principle that makes it zero. So although you got the scale right, you forgot that this is multiplied by zero. And zero times any big number is still zero. That might have worked. And in fact, supersymmetry does that. In many cases, a theory that is supersymmetric has the remarkable property that these fluctuations of the bosons are precisely canceled because of the symmetry by the fluctuations of the fermions. And by the way, that's one of the reasons we can do a lot of things in string theory, is because we work in situations where supersymmetry is exact. And then the cosmological constant does cancel. And then space-time is flat. Once the cosmological constant gets turned on, it curves space-time, and we couldn't do most of the things we've done to explore string theory. However, supersymmetry is not a feature of the real world, as we just discussed. It is broken. So back of the envelope would say that lambda should be of order the scale breaking of supersymmetry, which we know is not any smaller than a TV, 1,000 GeV, and that gives us 10 to the 48 electron volts to the fourth. That's helped a bit, but if we turn to experiment, we know that this is no bigger than the energy density that is determined by the global properties of the universe, and certainly should be less than that necessary to close the universe. And that's 10 to the minus 8 electron volt to the fourth. So this is a big problem. In some sense, it's the major problem for string theory, because we are going to have to face up to breaking supersymmetry, which is difficult to understand, and somehow being consistent with this bound, or explaining why it should really vanish. And even worse, there is now experimental evidence, as you all have heard, that the universe is accelerating. And that means that there is a cosmological constant of this order of magnitude. And it seems that string theory has real problems dealing with that. Some people have suggested that in situations like this, the theory can only have a finite number of degrees of freedom, which, if true, would be truly a bizarre and revolutionary statement. So at the moment, this is one of the most problematic and important questions for string theorists and anyone else who wants to understand the large-scale structure of the universe. Question number 7 was, what are the fundamental degrees of freedom of M-theory, and does the theory describe nature? So here, Hiroshi also discussed this. This has something to do with this picture of the different ways we describe string theory. There used to be these 5 different theories, which we now understand are deeply connected in different parts of some same theory. M theory is used by different people for different things, but I think it's most appropriate a description of what turns out to be the strong coupling limits of these more two familiar versions of string theory. It turns out that these theories, as one makes the parameters that describe how strong the forces are bigger, and one can do that consistently in treatments of these theories in certain regimes. The theory is then described by a theory that's sometimes called M-theory, which we know very little about. All we know is that it looks like an 11-dimensional theory of gravity, of supergravity, supersymmetric gravity, at low energies, but we don't understand its properties at high energies. Unlike these theories, which are describable in terms of strings, which we understand for all energies at weak coupling. So this theory, called M-theory sometimes, is a little mysterious, and some people believe that it is the secret of the whole schmear, simply because they don't understand it. These other different versions of string theory are all valid descriptions in some regimes and related by other dualities. T-duality that interchange the radius of a compactified dimension with the inverse radius, takes a theory on a small circle to a theory on a big circle, and relates these two different versions, which have stringy descriptions. And there are other bizarre connections or dual realizations of these theories in terms of totally different types of language. Here one has versions of string theory, which are ordinary field theories. Here one has versions of M-theory, which are ordinary quantum mechanical systems. This is just symptomatic of the fact that we don't really know what string theory is. And I'm a point we think all the speakers have come back to, I hope, over and over again. String theory is a work in progress. And what the theory really is, and without prejudice to the name, we don't know. So the 8th question was one that was addressed by Hiroshi again. What is the resolution of the black hole information paradox? A very important conceptual problem for any theory of quantum gravity. And this has been explained. You drop into a black hole ordered stuff, and it radiates disordered radiation. And you seem to lose information. And that is in conflict with the laws of quantum mechanics. If quantum mechanics is correct in a very general sense, you can't lose information. Now, as Hiroshi told you, string theory has been extremely successful in accounting for certain properties of black hole, such as the entropy or the number of states, the microscopic number of states of a quantum black hole. But so far, the tools of string theory haven't been powerful enough to follow this time evolution. Although, there's an overwhelming feeling in the community that since we can sort of map this problem where information appears to be lost onto an analogous or dual problem where information is guaranteed to be preserved, then there is a resolution of this paradox, but it hasn't been worked out yet. And answering this question will teach us a lot about string theory and its relation to ordinary descriptions of gravity. The ninth question was, what physics explains the enormous disparity between the gravitational scale, the Planck mass, and the typical mass scale of the elementary particles? This is the hierarchy problem that's been remarked on. The traditional answer is supersymmetry. And in fact, that's the strongest phenomenological, down-to-earth, practical argument for supersymmetry, which is broken at about 1,000 GV. And if that's the case, we might be able to observe it in a year or two. And the way that happens mathematically is, Hiroshi said it's very hard to predict a number of like 10 to the 19. It's just hard to get that out of an equation. And what happens in supersymmetry, and I won't go through the specific mechanism, is it turns out the number you have to predict is not 10 to the 19, but log of 10 to the 19. And log of 10 to the 19 is a number of like 19. And that's not so hard to predict. And in fact, in this theory, it comes out to be 1 over a coupling, which is maybe 1/19. So it converts a number that is totally unnatural, and physicists use that term, unnatural, to a number that is very natural and calculable. And this mechanism is very nice. All the experimental data we know makes it more and more convincing over the years and gives us a lot of faith that supersymmetry is there around this regime and will be observed. There are other possibilities. These brain world scenarios that Hiroshi remarked on give a totally different kind of picture. They say you might have been mistaken in thinking that the unification or the string or the Planck scale are so high. And there might be other ways of making gravity weak at low energies, is really where this comes from. And in that case, we have even more interesting surprises in the TV regime, because gravitational and stringy effects could become big. There are even people who talk about the possibility, and experimenters who think about it, of producing black holes in proton-proton collisions at the LHC, or having gravitons escape into the extra large dimensions in these high energy collisions, and noticing that because energy is lost. So these scenarios, if true, and in my opinion that's very unlikely, but it's possible, would be fascinating answers to this question. Finally, the last question seems to have nothing to do with string theory, but is actually the most valuable question. There is a math institute that just started a few years ago. Some wealthy philanthropist gave a lot of money to found an institute to promote pure mathematics. And they decided to celebrate the millennium by having their own list of questions, except they had $1 million attached to each of those questions. So they formulated 7 questions, and if you answer them to their satisfaction, they'll pay you $1 million. And one of them is a question in physics. And it's a question about the Standard Model, about a part of the Standard Model that we haven't yet completed, theoretically. And that's understanding why quarks never get out of protons, why they're confined into protons in QCD, which is part of our Standard Model. It's a theory of the nuclear force. Now, you might ask, why did string theorists ask this question? And part of the reason is the following. It turns out the best way to solve this problem is to consider QCD, which is a theory of quarks, in the limit as you take the number of colors of quarks. Quarks, you remember, have 3 colors. There are 3 kinds of quarks. And it's the color charge that drives the forces. And if you imagine a theory which has an infinite number of quarks, now, that's taking 3 to infinity. You might think that 3 is not close to infinity, but actually, that's not such a bad approximation. 1 over the corrections when you derive things in this limit are like 1 over n squared, 1 over 3 squared is 1/10. And in physics, sometimes, if you can calculate something to 10%, that's great. Then you work a lot harder and you calculate the 1%. Anyway, in that limit, it turns out that you can convince yourself that hadrons, that protons and neutrons and stuff like that, mesons, look very much like strings. That the spectrum in this limit of the theory consists of lots of particles which are very weakly interacting and look very much like strings. Mesons look like pi meson and things like that look like a quark here and an anti-quark here with a tube of flux, of this color flux between them, and behave very much like strings. And then there are things called glue balls which behave like closed strings. And this is not really surprising, because I hope that somebody told you a word or two about the early history of string theory. It was discovered in an attempt to understand the properties of mesons. And it took years before we realized we were discussing a theory of strings. So it's not surprising that hadrons actually look a bit like strings. And in this kind of approach, you could solve the problem of really controlling QCD and understanding quarks and gluons by string theory methods. And so understanding this question, aside from being worth $1 million, will benefit and contribute to our understanding of string theory. And in fact, there are many attempts to solve this question by using string theory itself. Okay, that ends my discussion of the ten top questions. Now I want to discuss a bit these conceptual revolutions. One of them I've already discussed, the initial conditions of the universe. I really want to focus on the nature of space-time, about which we've heard quite a bit. And I want to give you some quotes from a newspaper article that was written a year or two ago in the LA Times and quoted some string theorists. "Space and time may be doomed," Ed Witten. "I'm almost certain that space and time are illusions." Andy Strominger said, "The notion of space-time is clearly something we're going to have to give up." Sidney Coleman, who's not exactly a string theorist, said, "If you ask questions about what happened at very early times, like at the beginning of the universe, and you compute the answer is time doesn't mean anything." And I will quote myself as well, much more sober statement. "The real change that's around the corner is the way we think about space-time. We haven't come to grips with what Einstein taught us, but that's coming, and it will make the world around us stranger than any of us can imagine." And I really believe in that. Now, why do all these people believe that space-time is doomed? Well, I'll give you a variety of reasons. I mean, since we don't know what it means to say that it's doomed, I can't explain that, but I can tell you why we feel it's doomed. Well, one thing we can do, as we just discussed, is change the number of dimensions by cranking up a coupling. So we can take a theory which has, looks like it has 10 dimensions for weak coupling. That's why we're able to treat it. So one of these manifestations of string theory, which we treat because something is small, we can do expansions and treat this number as small. And using supersymmetry mostly as a tool, we can actually probe certain, we can describe certain features of this theory for strong coupling and discover that it actually looks like a theory in 11 dimensions. You can turn a coupling into a dimension. In a sense, the radius of one of the spatial dimensions of M theory, which is an 11-dimensional theory, that radius is the coupling of a 10-dimensional theory. For weak coupling, you don't see the circle. For a big coupling, the circle gets big, and you see a new dimension. So dimensions can come and go. You can, as I'm sure Brian discussed in his talk, tear the fabric of space continuously by starting with a string theory compactified on some manifold, some Calabi-Yau manifold. So you have a situation where, in this regime of solutions, the strings look like they're propagating with some internal space, which is compactified in some way, beautiful shape. And then you vary the parameters, and you sort of can't really describe what happens in the middle in the same terms, but you continuously vary the parameters, and you end up in a situation where the strings are propagating on some other manifold, yet it has a different topology, as if you've torn, ripped space, and put it together in a different way. Now, of course, in the string theory, continuously goes from here to here with no problem. Nothing bad happens, even though in the usual descriptions of theories living on some smooth space, this is totally impossible. From another point of view, if you try to imagine how you actually go about and try to and determine the microscopic nature of matter and of space itself, in an operational sense, well, you look at it. And you look at it with a microscope. And it's a useful exercise to redo what Heisenberg did in his analysis of the measurement of position and momentum that led to the uncertainty principle in the early days of quantum mechanics. Heisenberg noticed that you need a microscope in order to look at something with some resolution. But whenever you look at something like a quanta of light, a photon, a light ray, bounces off the object, it gives it a little kick. And if you want to have very good resolution, you need very high energy beams. That'll give it a bigger kick. So if the resolution in space is good, then the amount, the uncertainty in your knowledge of the object's momentum is bigger. That's the uncertainty relation. And we can do the same thing in string theory with one difference, namely, the objects we use in our microscope are not particles, like photons, but they're strings. Everything is a string. So we build a string microscope. And we can look at the string uncertainty principle. And we find an extra contribution to the uncertainty relation that says that the resolution and position that we measure using beams of energy E has a term coming from the fuzziness of quantum mechanics. This is the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And we can overcome that and make delta X, the resolution, very small by making E very big. But then we're pumping energy into this string. And the string can expand, in fact, does expand as you pump energy into it. So now you're trying to resolve a small object with a big string. And that won't work. So there's a delta X in uncertainty in the resolution, which is proportional to the energy. So if you increase the energy, you gain here, but lose here. There's a balance. And the minimum distance you can probe, of course, is going to turn out to be, this is Newton's constant, it's going to be of order the string length or the Planck length. So in a operational sense, in some sense, there's no meaning to asking about resolutions that are shorter than the string length. Because strings expand at high energies. You find the same thing if you try to get to short distances by squeezing spatial volumes. If you, say, take one of these compactification circles and apply a lot of force, get a big bulldozer and push on the circle and try to make it smaller, eventually of zero size, there's an incredible duality, symmetry of string theory that says that the description of string theory on a circle of radius r is the same. This string theory on a circle of radius r is, in fact, the same as string theory on a circle of radius 1 over r. These are just two different descriptions of the same thing. It's a little hard to grasp. It takes some time to explain. You have to slightly change your language, but there's an isomorphism. For every question you can ask here, there's an analogous question you can ask here with the same answer. And it would be natural for us to use this explanation because it's simple. And therefore, we would say that there simply is no meaning to having one of these internal circles smaller than, again, the string length. And if we tried to push it even smaller, we would just change our description a bit and it would, in effect, bounce back. This is, one of the ways string theory avoids singularities, avoids cases where things are pushed down to points. So, well, there's another thing maybe I'll say a word about, holography. Another feature of space and time that we're discovering that is very strange from the conventional point of view. It's an idea that arose in quantum gravity, and its strongest manifestation is in string theory nowadays, that in the theory of gravity, the fundamental degrees of freedom of a theory reside on the boundary of space-time. We actually have realizations of that in string theory, where theories that live in a space which sort of looks like this cylinder with the inside as well can be equally well described by theories that just live on the boundary. Again, that's a very strange concept that is very new. So we have hints, indeed, that space-time probably has to be, and in some cases can be, replaced by something else. Namely, that space is an emergent concept. Or holographically represented in the way I was discussing. Now, I can't tell you much more than reasons like this, but those are the reasons that lead the physicists I quoted and many others of us to really believe that space-time is an emergent concept, is something that is adequate to describe physics at large distances or large times compared with the origin of the universe, but is not, in some sense, fundamental. Democrates stated, I like to quote him when I discuss the atomic hypothesis, in a beautiful poem, the essence of the atomic hypothesis. He said, by convention there is color, by convention sweetness, by convention bitterness, but in reality there are atoms in space. And I think our feeling about space and time in string theory at the moment is that by convention there is space, by convention there is time, but in reality there is dot, dot, dot. Now, there is the final revolution is a little fuzzier. I'm not really sure what I'm saying, much less what I'm saying here. but I'll bring it up anyway, and that is the unification of kinematics and dynamics. This bears on the role of quantum mechanics in string theory. And traditionally in physics, we have a clear distinction between kinematics, which is sort of the general framework for understanding physics and its interpretation, the laws of quantum mechanics and the measurement theory, or classical mechanics. In the case of our present-day knowledge, it's really quantum field theory. And then we have dynamics, which are the specific laws of nature and the forms of matter. In the case of verified understanding, that's the standard model. Specific theory, quantum field theory, specific forms of matter. And these are two different things. You can have kinematics and you can put in all sorts of different dynamics. But in string theory, it seems to me unlikely that as we learn to understand the theory and explore, especially when we explore the nature of space-time, and perhaps find that even time is an emergent concept, we'll be able to keep this distinction. And since quantum mechanics is really the kinematical framework, it will be entwined with dynamics and probably could very well emerge as more inevitable and maybe less mysterious, although might very well turn out to be more mysterious. Okay, I'm going to end with a few philosophical comments about this general pursuit of these very ambitious unified theories of everything. And I'm going to just ask very briefly, can we go on forever? And you know, one statement that's sometimes made is that we might be too dumb. You know, it might be that the theory of everything, or understanding string theory, for example, might be something that we're just not equipped to handle, just like dogs cannot grasp quantum mechanics. Now, I have empirical evidence that this is not the case. And the empirical evidence is not the four of us, but rather our graduate students, who find it equally, have no problem getting to the frontier of knowledge today in a year or two from beginning their studies than they did 25 years ago or 100 years ago. If you look at graduate students, they are as smart today as they ever were, and they show no problem in getting immediately to the frontier of exploration. So there's no sign that we're too dumb yet. Well, maybe we can construct the final theory, in fact. And someday there'll be a conference like this, and just like the standard model, we'll tell you, well, it's here, it's all finished. And that might be the case. I'm agnostic. Would this be the end of physics? And even if we had a final theory, it would not be the end of physics. So let me say why I'm agnostic. And that has to do with what I like to call the geometry of knowledge. Some people like to describe knowledge as an onion. You peel away, you know, the metaphor, you peel away the bury further into the onion of knowledge. Well, I think it's the other way around. You're moving out into a sea of ignorance, and knowledge is where you already explored and what you already know. And this is a very good mathematical model of the geometry of knowledge. And as any model, it has certain things it explains. So it explains a lot of facts about knowledge, ignorance, and wisdom. So this is what we know. Most of it's, of course, in libraries. We know more or less what we just learned yesterday, and the rest we forget. But knowledge as a whole, especially, you know, as counted by what's in the library, increases. And it increases like the volume of this region of knowledge. But the important thing to note here is that ignorance is increasing as well. And it's increasing because we're here at the boundary, and we're aware of the ignorance right on the surface. And of course, the ignorance is therefore going up like the surface. Now, this explains, you see, in this mathematical model, just the opposite of the onion, by the way, that ignorance, the older you get, the more ignorant you are, something we all feel. The more we learn, the more ignorant we are. This, of course, is very important. Ignorance is precious. It's what drives knowledge. And you might say there's all this sea of ignorance, but we're not aware of this ignorance yet. We don't know enough. We're just aware of the ignorance that's close to us. And finally, this model explains a third fact, that even though the older we get, the more we learn, the more ignorant we are, we're still wiser, because wiser, wisdom is the ratio of knowledge to ignorance. And that increases as well, because... So what does this have to do with the theory of everything? Well, see, this is a mathematical theory of the local geometry of knowledge. The issue about a final theory is a question of the global geometry of knowledge. Namely, is the geometry of knowledge flat, like the flat world, or is it round, like the surface of the globe? If it's flat, this will go on forever. If it's round, we'll exhaust the sea of knowledge, just like we exhausted continents to explore. And sooner or later, exploration, you know, the kind of thing that Englishmen were very good at in the 19th century, ended. We ran out of ignorance about new areas of the world that weren't visited by white men. So the question about whether we'll be able to find a final theory really is whether the sea of ignorance is compact. And so far, we've just been exploring a little bit of it, and we don't know. Just like if you're limited to Santa Barbara, it's hard to tell whether the world is flat or round. And the way you know, obviously, is when ignorance starts to decrease. And you start running out of ignorance, which is very bad for scientists. Very hard to write grants if you're running out of ignorance. So far, there's no danger of that, and I am agnostic as to whether it goes on forever or is compact. But I would like to make a remark about whether this is the end of physics, and to give some humility to the effort of the physicists like us who try to explore the fundamental laws of nature. We all physicists, I think, are reductionists. They do believe that the laws of the universe have a certain directionality to them, and that the fundamental laws that we are looking for, the theory of everything, which might be string theory, is a theory of microscopic physics that is in some sense the basis for our standard understanding of the physical world, of the standard model and of gravity. And that if we had such a theory, and string theory shows you how this could happen, you could deduce the standard model and Einstein's gravity from that for large distances, large times. And then, of course, we already understand how, given the standard model, we can learn about the structure of atoms, nuclei, and from the structure of gravity, the history of the universe, cosmology. And once we understand atoms, we can understand ordinary matter and chemistry, biology, how stars work, and even fluid mechanics. There's actually a more direct connection between the theory of everything, string theory, and the structure of the universe, which I was just discussing, the cosmological constant. So the ties need not be so indirect. But this, of course, doesn't mean that if we could ever complete this and be satisfied that the sea of ignorance had shrunk to nothing, and we had a final theory, that we wouldn't have an immense reservoir of ignorance at all these other levels. And the theory of everything is not going to help you understand the wonderful problems which exist at all of these different stages. We already know enough standard models we know enough chemistry, hopefully, to understand life. So with that, I will end.
We're running a little late, but David said he'd still be happy to answer a few questions. So if you could please come to the mic.
In the holographic paradigm, if you take the system to be the entire universe, and you're trying to represent everything inside by a boundary of space and time, does that rule out or downgrade any thinking about models that have no space-time barrier? Or are we talking about a boundary of space and time in a different kind of a manifold?
Well, it's a very good question, to say the least. We have one example of, essentially one example of holography, and it doesn't look at all like our universe. And people are trying very hard to understand how universes that look more like our universe have holographic representations. So this is a principle that hasn't found its a general implementation, especially for universes that look like ours.
One of those questions, I believe, was number four. You were talking about supersymmetry, and you had your bosonic space and your fermionic space, and if I got it right, the bosonic commuted, the fermionic didn't commute. Are you saying then in all this that string theory does explain fermions and hence the Pauli exclusion principle?
Well, that's built into the underlying principles of which we construct the string theory. The existence of the exclusion principle and fermions, the exclusion principle is the fact that particles that are fermions have zero likelihood, probability of being at the same place at the same time, because when you interchange their position, the wave function that describes the system changes sign, so it actually must vanish when they're on top of each other. And that's part of any relativistic local causal theory, and certainly a part of string theory. We would have been very surprised if in constructing string theory we would have violated that very general principle, and it's there. But it really is a consequence of much more general principles, such as relativistic symmetry, relativity, and locality, causality.
I'm sort of wondering on the initial conditions where you abandoned from, you know, the more classical beginnings of your own physics studies, where, you know, you could only talk about the initial states of a system and then describe the final states knowing the boundary conditions. Now, is it a sort of, to say you have a universe that is sort of evolving and then you could work, is that like a working postulate that it evolves, so then if it evolves, then it has to evolve to fix the initial conditions? I'm looking at it as sort of like, I'm thinking of an incompleteness theorem type of thing. Are we sort of having to assume we have a solution and then go for it and not know if it's decidable or not? I don't know if I'm making sense to you, but I'm thinking of a sort of a logical paradox that might be sticking us in something like this.
Once you start thinking about these problems, a lot of paradoxes arise, believe me.
Is it possible that dark matter is hidden in some of the dimensions predicted by string theory?
As Hiroshi explained, there are sort of two scenarios for the extra dimensions. One is the Kaluza-Klein compactification, and in that case, we're actually in all those dimensions now. We're just smeared over them. You actually are there in 10 dimensions. In the other scenario where we live on a brain, then we're not there in the other six dimensions. And you can, and people have tried to put play around with those, with stuff in the extra dimensions for all sorts of purposes, including the dark matter problem. So, there are all sorts of possibilities and all sorts of, at the moment, room for speculation. Most of it is still at a very speculative stage.
This is probably a more philosophical question, but your question number one about are there all the measurable dimensionless parameters that characterize the physical universe calculatable principle, or are some of them merely determined by historical or quantum mechanics and dependent on calculator? It seems like are you making an assertion that those are the only two possibilities, and if so, are you making an assertion that those are the two types of accidents that can exist? And
well,
I think Hawking and Einstein used the word God there sometimes, and what, you know, I mean, are those carefully chosen words, or are they?
They're carefully chosen. They, to some extent, they left God out of it, and they assume. Well, you see, we would, in a dynamical sense, I mean, we do believe that there's some dynamics that. So it really is assuming, if you want, the same scenario that the second question assumes, that there is a scientific explanation for the origin of the universe.
Yeah, actually, it wasn't the God part I thought it was, just the question within that scientific framework, are there only those two types of accidents?
No, of course not. There could be other accidents. I think the distinction in that question, for most of us, is really between a situation where we have, in principle, a way of imagining, you know, given a big enough computer and enough time or enough good ideas, of calculating all the dimensionless parameters, or some of them might be simply inaccessible. And, I mean, there are speculations as to, in cosmological scenarios, that the universe is continually recreating itself, inflating little portions of the universe, go through quantum fluctuations and inflate away, and in each of these different universes that might or might not ever communicate in the future, there could be different values of these physical parameters. In that case, clearly, one would not be in a position that one could calculate them.
Okay, let's thank David again.